From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokheim. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Some members of the University of North Carolina System's Board of Governors want more input. You'll hear what they said during a surprisingly confrontational recent board meeting. The General Assembly is talking about redrawing election maps for North Carolina judges. It would be the first major overhaul of judicial election districts in decades. You'll hear pros and cons about the idea. You'll also hear from judges themselves. What do they think about the proposed changes? Plus, we'll share the good news and a red flag connected to North Carolina's recent budget situation. The state has enjoyed recent budget surpluses. You'll learn what North Carolina needs to do to maintain its sustainable fiscal path. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Will taxpayers be forced to help fund a ballpark in High Point? The Guilford County Board of Commissioners' vote to table a decision on this project is casting doubt on the project's future. Still, the city of High Point, the council there, seems to be moving ahead. Our own Julie Tisdale, who is the city and county policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation, has been following this story closely. She's here with an update. Julie, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
So for our listeners, let's quickly summarize exactly what this project is and where.
Absolutely. So the city of High Point has been talking about building a ballpark for a while now. They first started talking about it in 2015. There have been all kinds of sort of developments. But they got really serious about this in April when they allocated $15 million for land acquisition in downtown High Point. They found an area where they wanted to demolish the current buildings and build a ballpark to attract a minor league team to the area. That was in April. They said at that point that they'd like to partner with the county, but nothing really happened over the summer. Finally, in September, the county voted to have a public hearing on it. Then later in September, High Point City Council had their own public hearing and approved moving forward with the project. Then toward the end of September, Guilford had that public meeting and voted to delay the whole thing by 60 to 90 days. So they're going to meet again at some point later in the year, but it's not looking very good. Guilford County seems very reluctant to get on board with the project. Despite that, High Point voted on September 25th to develop an alternative financing plan and proceed with this project regardless of whether the county chooses to partner with them or not.
That's really interesting because clearly then the city council in High Point wants this ballpark. Do they have any chance at all of actually attracting a team? We're talking about baseball here, right? Minor league baseball.
Right. So there is an agreement in place to attract a team. They're planning to move a team that's part of the Atlantic League. That team would move from Bridgeport, Connecticut to High Point. And would start play the stadium would be built by 2019. They may actually move before that, but the stadium would be built in 2019. I'm not sure where they would play in the interim. That team is part of the Atlantic League, which is not actually the official minor league baseball league at all. So official teams in Greensboro and Winston-Salem, for example, are affiliated with major league clubs. So there's this pipeline. They're used for player development. Players move up and down that system. And there is a clear path to major league baseball for those players if they can achieve, you know, high enough performance.
So it is professional baseball, but it's at the entry level area.
It is, and it's just sort of outside the accepted system. So a few of those people may go on to sign major league contracts, but they're not affiliated with any team now. There's no clear path for that. So it's unlikely that very many of them will move on.
The city wants to go forward. Mm-hmm. And as you said, they apparently want to go forward regardless of what the county does.
Right.
Let's talk about the money and the relationship with the city and the county. First of all, could the city actually go ahead with this whole thing and if the county says no go?
The money is where this starts to get really, really interesting.
As always, right?
Absolutely. So they need $30 million to build the stadium. And High Point probably could come up with a way to finance that. It's a lot of money. High Point's a small town, but they could probably do that. Obviously, it's easier if you get Guilford County on board. They're bigger. They have more resources. Their original plan that Guilford's seeming very skeptical about is to designate 649 acres, which would be the stadium itself and then area around the stadium. And they wanted Guilford County to agree to forego any additional taxes that would be raised in that area for the next 20 years and use that revenue instead to pay back the debt from building the stadium. So it's a little bit of an interesting arrangement there. This is part of a larger project, too, though. Nito Cobain, who is the president of High Point University and an entrepreneur and very wealthy personally himself, has been heading this project to find community partners. So he has committed to raising the money for building a children's museum, a park, educational event spaces, all kinds of neat amenities around the ballpark. He's got investors who have committed to building a hotel, apartments, retail and office space. So it'd be this very mixed use, interesting kind of development. The one piece, and they've raised about $50 million in philanthropy and about $50 million in promises of private investment. So we're talking about substantial money here. The part that nobody seems to want to touch, into private money, is the ballpark itself, which raises some red flags to me. It makes it seem like maybe that's the weak link in this project.
So, Julie, what does this mean for taxpayers, whether it's they're paying city taxes or county taxes? Would taxpayers then have to actually pay additional tax or special tax, or would it be a situation where the county, for example, would just not collect tax and therefore not be taking in as much revenue from this special area around the stadium?
Right. So the sort of system that they want to set up is one where they envision there being additional tax revenue generated by all this economic growth, right? And so the city or the county would forego the additional revenue that would have been collected in that area and use it to pay down the debt. So that sounds great. It's kind of borrowing against future earnings, but it leaves a big question mark. What if the whole thing fails? What if the team doesn't perform well? What if nobody visits the Children's Museum? What if the team decides to leave after 5 years? There are just lots of questions about the numbers that are being presented. And if this plan doesn't quite work out, there is no alternative but the taxpayers being left to foot the bill.
So what would that mean then? Let's say worst case scenario, and certainly we don't want a project to fail and taxpayers to be on the hook, but that's one of the scenarios you have to look at as you analyze whether this project should go forward, and that's what you do here at the Locke Foundation. So what is the worst case scenario?
Worst case scenario is an increase in property taxes for High Point taxpayers, which we don't want to see. I would love for this project to be wildly successful and have another baseball team in High Point. I think that this whole mixed-use development sounds really cool, a children's museum and office and retail space and apartments. All of that sounds really cool, and I'd love to see it be successful. But if taxpayers have funded it and the whole thing is not as successful as we'd hoped, then they will be left footing the bill. So private investment, the private investors take on the risk, and I'm okay with that. Also, if it's wildly successful, they make a profit out of it, and that would be a great deal for the investors as well. It's good for the city. It's good for the investors. What I'm concerned about is taking the riskiest part of the project and funding that with taxpayer money. That's putting taxpayers at tremendous risk.
And Julie, it's not just in North Carolina. We see this across the country where many, many cities, they want to attract some sort of a professional sports team.
Right.
And typically they get into questions of should we build a stadium? And then usually beyond that, they start talking about hotels to be around the stadium and all that. But the analysis is always the interesting point. From your research, I mean, are these projects successful?
The economic research is actually pretty clear that they don't bring any economic benefit to the area.
And people would be surprised by that.
They would. But if you look at what happens to, say, per capita income, which is a pretty basic measure of how a city's doing, our income's going up or down. What we find is that stadiums do not bring up income for people in the city where they're located. If anything, there might even be a slight negative impact. So while sports are a lot of fun, you could make all kinds of arguments about quality of life. If we look at the economics, there's no real payoff for spending tons of money on a publicly funded stadium.
If you'd like to read about this, ballpark in High Point, you can check out johnlock.org for Julie Tisdale's writings on it, and also carolinajournal.com. There's a new story there as well. Julie Tisdale, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A Confederate memorial statue at UNC Chapel Hill named Silent Sam helped spark one of the liveliest debates in memory among the UNC Board of Governors. A majority of the board sent a letter to the board chairman and UNC President Margaret Spellings. The letter criticized them for not seeking the full board's input about how to deal with demands to remove the Silent Sam statue. New member Tom Fetzer discussed the letter at the next board meeting.
I heard from some of you. Some of you took umbrage with the letter and opined about the public way in which these things were addressed. And a couple of you mentioned concern about a lack of consensus on the board. And I wanted to read you a definition of consensus from one of my heroes and one of the great political leaders of the 20th century, Lady Margaret Thatcher, who said, "Consensus, the process of abandoning all beliefs, principles, values, and policies in search of something in which no one believes but to which no one objects, the process of avoiding the very issues that have to be solved merely because you cannot get agreement on the way ahead, what great cause would have been fought and won under the banner, I stand for consensus." So I just want to suggest to you, I'd like to hold the prism up to the light from a slightly different angle and suggest to you that divisions in this board, if respectful, will be very healthy. If we were all unanimous, we wouldn't need 28 of us. We could get by with one, and these meetings could be done a lot more quickly and efficiently. Raging internal conflict is a long-held American tradition, and I think even the casual student of history would have to agree that nothing great in this country occurred without a raging, raucous, robust, passionate debate beforehand.
Member Joe Knott responded to Fetzer's comments.
I appreciate your comments about division, and I completely concur. We do not ever need to be to sacrifice principle for consensus or for anything else, for that matter. We ought to have complete, open, and respectful debate. That's what we're here for. That's what we're trying. That's why we have a university, to train the next generation to know how to do that. I think we've been failing a little bit in teaching people how to have respectful debates. But I will take, and I'm not in any way making an attack, because I realize I've been in heated situations myself. But to for a group of the board to sign a letter and send it to the president criticizing her without consulting the rest of us I never saw the letter. I had no opportunity to have any input into it. And I took that. I didn't read it. I didn't study it. I didn't take it apart. But it struck me as sort of a public rebuke. And I think before we do that, we have to realize that this is the University of North Carolina we're talking about. This is an institution that was here when George Washington was walking the earth. This is an institution that has been kept open and provided for by the people of North Carolina for hundreds and hundreds of years through very difficult circumstances, wars and depressions and divisions and political ups and downs and all sorts of things. The people of North Carolina have loved this institution, and it has come to us to be stewards of it. We should be very careful never to do damage to it.
The discussion then opened up to other topics, from tuition to the size of the university's administration to the location of the administration office. Member Bill Webb raised concerns about policies, such as the university's treatment of Title IX complaints.
We have, as I understand it, people who investigate complaints which could result in expulsion or lengthy suspensions, who receive very little training. We have a hodgepodge, and this is not a criticism. It's a lack of guidance, I think, because of a lack of discussion. A hodgepodge of people who make decisions in this area. You know, having been a judge for 14 years, and the attorneys around the room full well understand that these are complex issues that oftentimes intersect with law, facts, university policy, and I think it would serve our board well to discuss these issues in a mature fashion as we're doing today. And I commend the chairman and the president for facilitating this. And I would hope that we would find a way, as we go forward, to incorporate a lot more discussion of things that aren't transactional in nature, but impinge on policy and develop policy.
A proposed task force on the future of UNC's general administration sparked this exchange between Joe Nott and Board Chairman Lou Bissett.
The chancellors are her employees. They're not our employees. So we are undermining her administrative and supervisory power over her own employees by opening a back door for communication. And this is chaos. And I would think long term that is not good for the health of the university system.
Let me just be clear here. I mean,
I mean no offense, Mr. Chairman. I mean no offense to Governor Rucho or anyone else. I'm raising a concern.
We're having a good, robust discussion, just like Governor Fetzer warned us to have. So we're having it.
Board member Philip Byers explained why he and some colleagues decided to speak out.
We came on during a very tough time, and there wasn't a whole lot of trust going around with this group because we weren't involved with the selection of our president. I think we got the best president ever, and I do support her wholeheartedly, and our chairman as well. But I think we were pushed into a corner, and when I asked simple questions, like I'd like to see the top three candidates' resumes, or I'd like to know who they are, I was told to sit down and be quiet. Well, an old country boy sheriff from the mountains don't like to be told to sit down and be quiet. And so I thought it was just me, and I thought, well, maybe I don't need to be around here after all. Maybe the representatives made a mistake. And I got to asking the rest of the group, and they were getting the same thing. We weren't involved. So a wall was built that there was no trust between the administration and the new governors. I keep hearing today about the Tom's letter. Tom's letter would have never existed if we'd have gotten a phone call saying, hey, we're sending the governor a letter. I read about it in the newspaper. We also had a homicide on this campus that I got phone calls from students from this campus, and I read about it in the paper. If I'm going to be a governor of this institution, we're going to have to do better communicating. Let's not just focus on my friend Tom Fetzer's letter. Let's talk about reality. We send a letter to a governor, and I read about it on Tuesday in the damn News and Observer. During the time at Tom, we were putting a letter together, and I was one of the 15, and we were doing all these other things. Would it not have been better to be talking about educating the kids of this state? Instead of, they did this, and we're going to do this, and now let's... How about let's communicate with each other and start focusing on lower tuition, educating the kids of this state? I do support you, and I do support these new folk that are coming around with some new ideas, because the right answer is not, that's the way we've always done it, out of respect. That's, times have changed. We don't need to do things the way we've always done them.
You've been listening to highlights from one of the liveliest debates on record from the UNC Board of Governors. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. State lawmakers are debating whether to redraw maps for North Carolina judicial elections. There's been no major overhaul of those maps since the 1950s. Republican Representative Justin Burr says now is the time for change.
We're simply 60 years later looking to update, to modernize, to clean up those districts that have seen 60 years worth of piecemeal changes that have created a really what I see to be districts that are inefficient and resources that are in the wrong area that could be better utilized, as was mentioned by a number of our committee members, where we have limited dollars in the judicial branch to take those limited dollars we have and to make sure that they are spent and utilized as efficient as possible and in the best interest of the taxpayers and the folks that go before those in the judicial system, and to make sure that we are being consistent so that urban counties in this state are all treated the same and have the same manner for electing their judges. Those rural counties, the same structure there as well for the rural areas, and to actually have that versus what we have today under the existing structure, which is very much piecemealed and disjointed in a lot of areas and in need of repairs.
Democratic Representative Rodney Moore isn't convinced that lawmakers should vote on any maps now. He wants a more detailed, thorough study.
We very much need to look at the reconfiguration of these lines, but we also have to do it meticulously and methodically and with great thought, because this, we're talking about change, a drastic change judiciary in North Carolina. We understand the three levels of government. We know that we make the laws. We know the executive branch executes the laws. And we also know that the judiciary interprets and holds those laws. So we have to be very, very sensitive and very, very mindful of the task that we're taking here. And I am in favor of taking this process into the next legislative session, or at least work until the short session, because guys, we need to get this right. We're talking about 60 years of we've done some tweaks, but we're talking about a major overhaul of our justice system, how it's ran and how it's configured in North Carolina. And so this is not a Mickey Mouse task.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent debate involving election maps for district and superior court judges across North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As state lawmakers discuss redrawing election maps for judges across North Carolina, they're hearing ideas from those judges. District Court Judge Athena Brooks started her remarks during a recent hearing by referencing the work of the John Locke Foundation.
Recently, Becky Gray of the John Locke Foundation noted in her article in the Carolina Journal entitled Redrawing Judicial Districts, Make Sure We Get It Right. Changes to the judicial system that affect every North Carolinian deserve careful thought, advice from experts, thorough review, tough scrutiny, and thorough debate. As an aside, Ms. Gray points to the Courts Commission as the entity best equipped to handle this task.
Brooks went on to read from the official position adopted by the group that represents district court judges across North Carolina.
Although some realignment and redistricting in the courts might be needed, the process needs to be done in a transparent and orderly fashion, with input from a wide variety of citizens, legislators, and court officials. The maps as presented in House Bill 717 force turnover in a short period of time that will result in disruption to the bench and the administration of justice. In several districts, between 20 to 50% of the district court judges will be replaced by 2020, either by double bunking or by having the positions eliminated. These judges will be replaced without any regard to their fitness or job performance, which will result in the loss of years of judicial experience. The new districts which are drawn in these districts have few lawyers living in those districts. They are Republican-leaning without many lawyers living in them. As a result, there will be few candidates to choose from for these positions. Further, as I can tell you about from my own district, when you split a judicial district, you tax the resources that are already in place. My district split in 2006. It split from five counties to two districts of three and two. We did not get new judicial assistants. We didn't get new clerks. We didn't get new staff. So for over 10 years, for my four judges, I've had one judicial assistant, and she's had to manage about 2,500 cases. That's civil. That's not juvenile delinquency, abuse, neglect, and dependency, and criminal. That's only the civil cases. Redistricting is a process which should be accomplished in a deliberate manner through a process which includes all judicial and legal stakeholders with the ultimate goal of the fair and impartial administration of law and justice always at the forefront of the process.
Superior Court Judge Joe Crosswhite recounted his colleagues' initial reaction to the proposed shakeup of their election maps.
Take a measured and collaborative approach to any changes in our districts and our division. And that has not changed. That continues as our policy to this day.
Crosswhite says Superior Court judges realize that the General Assembly can redraw judicial election maps.
We all fully understand that it is the job of the General Assembly to establish judicial districts and divisions, and I think we all respect that. I think this committee has a special skill set that no judge could bring to this table. However, there is a lot of experience and a lot of wisdom in the field where judges live, and they know what is best for each individual district. For example, I'm from the 6th Division, which is in the middle of the state, and I cannot begin as the president of this conference to address the concerns that are either in the 1st Division down east or the 8th Division, which is out west. They all have their unique concerns that can only be addressed by their people that are on the ground. There is no need to rush this process. I think we just heard a little bit ago that the last major revision that we had to our districts happened over 60 years ago. So I'm urging this body just to take a measured approach, to do your research, to gather your facts, and to make a systematic, collaborative decision on what is going to be best for our court system.
Crosswhite emphasized the importance of judicial stability and predictability.
In a recent poll, the North Carolina court system was ranked 7th in the country in its legal climate. Two of the reasons we ranked so high were because of our stability and our predictability in the system that we offered. I really went back and forth on whether or not I wanted to include this last portion of my remarks in here, but I decided I think to. Several years ago, I had the privilege to see a court system that did not have stability and did not have predictability. It was in Afghanistan, and I was there as part of the military, and my job in Afghanistan was to help establish the courts in the southern part of the country. I got invited to watch a murder trial in the Helmand province, and they had been through multiple systems, multiple changes in the last couple of years. The defendant, as I indicated, was charged with murder. He had one witness, that was his mother, who came thinking she could testify, but because she was a female, she could not testify. The judge, without a jury, heard about 5 minutes of evidence. They convicted the guy, the defendant, of murder, and the judge sentenced them to death. The defendant tried to appeal, but the judge, I think because of the other players there, was trying to present the appearance of stability, and he denied the defendant's appeal, and the defendant was executed 4 days after that. We are privileged in this country, and I tell juries after every single jury trial, and I've been doing it for 10 years now, that we are blessed to have the best form of government in our courts anywhere in this country. But we have that because we have stability and predictability. Our citizens know what to expect, and they know how to access justice. There are always rooms for improvement, and I know that's what this committee is attempting to do. And I don't think we are in any position to try to block that, but we want to just be a part of the conversation. We want to make sure this is a systematic and collaborative approach. We don't want anything to happen that's going to cause this to be destabilized or to cause us to go back. I guess the bottom line of my message is we don't need to rush to make any changes. We have the time.
District Court Judge Robert Steele reminded lawmakers of the last time North Carolina courts faced a major realignment.
The 1,500 different types of courts that were in existence in 1955 with a hodgepodge of jurisdictions, how they collected their pay for the judicial officials, whether they traveled or not, simply was not working properly for the citizens. And it took the Bell Commission 4 years, and they went to the legislature, and it took the legislature in 59, in 61, in 63, and finally in 1966, adopting what we now say we haven't looked at things in the last 50 to 60 years, and it's the time. It was a deliberative, concerted effort, and it has spanned three generations in success. And I think that formula of looking backwards at history and looking forward to how we can best design our legal system commands that same method and attention.
You've been listening to judges' reactions to plans for redrawing state judicial election maps. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke with an E.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. For the past several years, state lawmakers have kept state spending growth in check. They've put away record amounts of money into a savings account, and they've cut the overall tax burden for North Carolinians. That's all well and good, says our next guest, but he also cautions that if we want to keep the state on a sound fiscal path, we need to think very seriously about the spending decisions that are ahead. Joe Coletti is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He's been writing about this at johnlocke.org. Joe, welcome back.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Okay, so things have been pretty good in terms of fiscal decisions for the past several years, but you're still concerned. Why?
Well, spending growth has been about 2.5% for the last few years. Up until last year, it was about 3.8%, and this year it's looking about the same amount. And that sounds like it's all well and good. It's within the what we normally look at as for inflation and population growth. It stays within those bounds. But we have revenue growth is going to be much slower than expected, that or in the five-year forecasts. Revenue growth is staying at about that 2.5% rate. So if spending continues at 3.8%, then that's a problem. And the Fiscal Research Division of the General Assembly says that spending is going to grow even faster. So that's where the concern starts coming.
So essentially you're saying, okay, you've got two things you need to look at. One is what you take in. That's your tax revenue, your fees, et cetera. And the other thing is what's going out the door, what you're spending. And you've been writing, Joe, that spending is going to be increasing, even though there has been a real effort to try to keep that under control. So how is that possible? It's kind of counterintuitive.
It is. And when the Senate and the House were first looking at lowering tax rates in 2019, this session, the General Assembly's Fiscal Research Division said this is going to lead to billion-dollar deficits, because they take a look at what current spending is, project that out for inflation, population growth, and you run into much faster spending growth than what the General Assembly has been doing. And so that's where the difference starts to come in, is that the General Assembly has been showing restraint. If you don't do anything, then you end up with more rapid growth. It just means that they have to continue making difficult decisions on what they spend and where they spend it in order to keep spending in line. And you need to keep spending in line, because I mentioned that economic growth is slow, and so that means revenue growth will be slow. When you add in the tax cut on top of that, that brings you back to that 2.5% growth rate. And so you really have to get spending in line to be able to maintain that and keep a balanced budget through this.
So, Joe, let me play devil's advocate here. For those who have not been on board with the decisions that the General Assembly has made over the last several years, they could be listening to us and they might say, well, see, I told you so. It's all that, the tax rate reductions, reducing the overall tax burden, that's the problem. But actually, you write that that's not the problem at all.
Now, the problem is that we have slow growth. We have slow economic growth. And so when you have slow economic growth, that means that your tax revenues are going to be slow. And that rate of growth is less than the projected rate of spending growth if we keep everything on autopilot. And so regardless of what we did with taxes, where we're starting spending now projected out leads to some imbalances regardless of what happens.
Let's talk about some of those areas where the growth is projected. First of all, Medicaid. What's happening there?
Well, Medicaid's Medicaid. It's always expensive and it grows fast. You have projected increases in population who use Medicaid and health spending increases. And so that leads to Medicaid spending projected at about 27% over the next 5 years.
And people may not realize what a huge chunk of the state budget that Medicaid takes up. I mean, it's a big appropriation.
It's the second largest thing behind K-12 education. So it's about $3.5-4 billion out of our $23 billion general fund. Then you add the federal spending on top of that, and it becomes astronomical. But it's the second largest thing, and it grows faster than anything else.
And that's why there's been such an effort over the past few years to try to rein in some of the administrative costs, to make sure that people are getting quality care, but it's the care they need and not unnecessary tests and things like that.
Yeah, the move to managed care and setting up the reserve fund for Medicaid. Those are some of the steps, because they know that this growth will happen if we don't get it under control. And that's where managed care and some of the other steps and the continued reform of Medicaid will come in.
You also write about the UNC system. What's ahead there with spending?
UNC, it's mostly population growth or enrollment growth. And inflation is about the same rate as everything else. But there's projection that enrollment in the UNC system will be much faster than will continue at a rapid pace. This does not necessarily include what happens when you have $500 tuition at some of these places, and how do you offset that with appropriations. But this goes to some of the reforms that are happening at the UNC system that we've seen from the Board of Governors there, that they're looking at how do we keep spending in line? How do we what do we do with our funding formula? How is it that we reform the UNC system itself within the system so that we don't have this kind of rapid growth?
We know as well, Joe, that State Treasurer Dale Falwell and others have been looking at the issue of what happens with employee benefits that have been promised and yet money hasn't been set aside, those so-called unfunded liabilities. You've also taken a look at employee benefits and compensation. What do you find?
Those are things that we're going to have to set aside more money for. And so that makes finding reductions in the rest of the state budget even more important. Two other areas, savings reserve and capital spending, were things that were done off budget, kind of before you start spending appropriations, and those are moving on budget. And so those will continue. Those three things, the retiree benefits, capital, and savings, will eat up more of what the potential appropriations are, which means that we have to really find savings in other places.
So, Joe, I'm sure that people would, when they read your piece at johnlock.org or they're listening to us talk about it, Medicaid, the UNC system, state employee benefits and compensation, capital expenditures, they're saying, hey, those are all important things. Yes. So what is your recommendation to legislators who have to be the ones to really put the pencil to the paper? What do they do?
Yeah, well, in all of these areas, they just have to continue what they've been doing, which is looking for ways to save money, looking at what are the programs that we need to, that we can stop doing. And they've been doing a great job of it the last few years, keeping the spending at just 2.5%. They need to continue doing that and take an even harder look at every program that's out there so that we can reduce that spending so that we can keep it in line with revenues.
I'm going to put you on the spot in our remaining moments here. If you were the person who had to make the decisions, which of these areas would you look at first to try to rein in spending?
First place would be Medicaid because it's the largest and it's growing the fastest. And you have the most room there, especially with the friendly administration in Washington, to be able to get some waivers and get that program and reform the program in a positive way.
It's really important decisions that are coming up for state policymakers here. And our guest, Joe Coletti, has been writing about this. In fact, you can read his piece on this at johnlock.org, the headline, Saving Now for a Better State Budget Tomorrow. Joe Coletti is a senior fellow for the Locke Foundation. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
That's all the time that we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.